So that's actually a really good introduction to our talk, and hits a lot of the main points that we'd like to hit too. So I'm Tricia Acree. I'm a family doctor, and Kevin Moore, my co-presenter, is a clinical psychologist, and we come from Sharon Hill, Pennsylvania, which is in Delaware County, which has the third highest prevalence of HIV, the county with the third highest prevalence of HIV in the state. And I'll tell you a little bit more about our clinic as I go on. We have no relationships to disclose. So as I said, it's the third highest prevalence of HIV in the state. We are located on what is locally known as Heroin Highway. 30% of our population has substance abuse. There's also approximately 100 people at a time in our clinic population, so about 20% who are homeless or marginally housed. And of course, you know, they tend to come in and out of care for both substance abuse and homeless reasons. Also a very high prevalence of patients who have previously been incarcerated or will ultimately be incarcerated. So what we did was and I'll also say too, our population is about 78% African American, and something like 24% co-infected with Hep C. Our methods were that we are going to present our baseline data of HRSA performance measures for patient retention and adherence. And we took a random 50% sample of our 531 clinic patients that are seen at two of our sites. And those are our Sharon Hill site and our Chester site. So to talk a little bit more about our clinic, we have scattered site locations. And so this is two of our clinics that we looked at in detail here. Our others are in Reading, Pennsylvania. We have some affiliation with a site in Kensington, which is in the city of Philadelphia as well. I want to go kind of to the money slide first, which is our cascade. So we did very well in comparison to the Philadelphia EMA, the eligible metropolitan area, and the United States as a whole. Now, a couple of caveats here. So 100% linked to care is not right, of course. So we started with linked to care because that's what we have, because it's patients who are linked into our system. So we don't really know the larger number of who. Let me tell you a little bit more, too, about how I got to the data, and I'll explain that a little better, because that doesn't entirely make sense. Okay, so I kind of should do this backwards, but I won't. So let me talk a little bit more about my methodology for using pharmacy refill adherence. I've done a little bit of work in adherence, primarily looking at methods of measuring adherence. And the method is to use the refill dates that people went to the pharmacy to pick up their prescription. So if you use mail order pharmacy and your patients get their prescriptions delivered to their house, this doesn't work. If they have to pick it up somewhere, it does. So only a limited number of the 531 patients in our clinic population have this data available. But what you do is you take the number of days supply. So if they got a 30-day supply and it took them 31 days to get back to the pharmacy because they went on January 1 and they went again on February 1, their adherence would be 96.8%, which is very good. But if it took them 2 to 3 months to get back to the pharmacy, it would be pretty poor. It would be like 30%. So you get the idea. And in general, what I found in our data was that people either came back a day or two before they needed to, so at 29 days or so, or it took them 2 or 3 months to get back. And by pharmacy, I mean picking it up in our office. Self-reported adherence, how many doses have you missed in the last 2 weeks, is asked at nearly every visit with a medical patient. If no doses were missed, then adherence was calculated as 100%. There's a very high ceiling effect here. You know, we know a lot about adherence and how we ask about it. So you're taking all your medications, right? Isn't it really the right way to go about it? What you ought to do with your patients is you ought to say things like, you know, we know it's really hard to take your medicines and everybody has a lot of trouble taking their medicines. And, you know, you'll have a better effect that way. So then linked to care was patients who were entered in the EMR, because we started using Practice Fusion in 2012, at the end of 2012. So patients who were entered had been seen that year, and they had data. So that's kind of my definition for linked. Retained in care, then, I used the HRSA definition, 2 visits at least 3 months apart in the last 12 months. on antiretroviral therapy was defined by the med list and the EMR. For the most part, if people weren't in care, they weren't on ART, is the way I defined it. And then undetectable adherent. So to go in, if they were undetectable, they were undetectable. That was it. They got that criteria. If they were not, and we defined it too strictly, so we used less than 50 rather than less than 200, as I've seen some others do. But if there was no viral load available, then I defined it based on the pharmacy refill adherence, and it had to be, I used 100% or greater because people were coming back a day or two before if they were doing it. And if there was no viral load and no pharmacy refill adherence, then I used 100% self-report. Our abstract said 95, but it was 100%. And so then I compared our data to the U.S. and to the EMA and Philly. So Delaware County, because even though it's a collar county outside of Philadelphia, is actually in the eligible metropolitan area for Philadelphia. That's just the way our state's divided up. And the original data from the EMA and from the U.S. is from the Medical Monitoring Project, which is a national probability sample of HIV-infected people in the U.S. And as I said, it's of those linked to care. So I recalculated their stuff to compare. And that's it. So Kevin will take over.
So I want everyone to be absorbing this slide. This is actually pretty cool. I think this is kind of something of the holy grail in the Ryan White world in terms of having agency or site-specific Gardner Cascade to look at exactly what you're doing and what you can do to improve. So if you look at this, like, we're doing pretty well, but there is a bit of a drop-off there. If you look between on ART and adherent undetectable, there's, even though we're doing well, that's a number of people. What can we do about those number of people and that specific piece of the cascade and the gap in care? So based on this data, we are saying, we're recommending that the folks who are caught in that gap, who can do better, would benefit from an integrative, interdisciplinary, collaborative, co-located primary care, behavioral health, patient-centered medical home. Say that very quickly. So I'm a clinical psychologist, and what Dr. Acri and I try to do is try to work very closely together with the same patients to integrate as much as possible and to provide sort of additional services that can change these gaps. So let me back up and break down what I mean by that very long recommendation. So patient-centered medical home is built on, you know, these main six principles: data-driven improvement, empanelment and panel size management, team-based care, population management, continuity of care, and prompt access to care. And this definition gets bantered around a little bit. I mean, there's some variance, but this is more or less what all the different definitions come back to. But we believe that there needs to be a diversity of forms in patient-centered medical homes. So you need to have a lot of different models, try them all out, see what works. NCQA is obviously the most dominant credentialing body for patient-centered medical homes, but we want to recommend to you today that perhaps they don't have the corner on that market either. If you're a small practice, and most Ryan White clinics are small practices if you look nationally, credentialing is burdensome. It's hard to do. If you don't have a lot of administrative staff, it's just hard just to, you know, get what you got to get done every day. And so what we're going to present to you here is based on organizational psychology and what we think works best. So we think smaller is better. Even though our clinic is maybe of a moderate size, right, that we're not as disadvantaged as even more rural and sort of, you know, smaller Ryan-wide entities, when we're trying to target what we're doing for folks who are falling in the gaps, who can do even better than the care that they're receiving, we think that you need a small team, six or eight people, that all work together, that know each other, that have a shared patient caseload. So that's the empanelment portion, and it's continuity of care. We're going to take care of all of their needs within this team indefinitely, right? And so we think that we're capturing this spirit and the essence of a patient-centered medical home in a new and different way. And now this is a team, of course, that's nested within these other resources that we have. You heard Dr. Strauss earlier talk about how we have a pharmacy component, dental services, nutrition, et cetera, housing that these things are necessary tools in sort of increasing adherence. And I think that's part of why we're doing so well in the Cascade, is because we have all these services available. But even with those services available, there needs to be sort of additional steps. Thank you. So the Ryan White Care Act has created all these different clinics that are all sort of uniquely situated throughout the country, each to their own local population, their own community needs. They all look very differently. But still, we can do better than we're doing. And so we think that a small team is actually an answer that is going to work in a lot of very different types of sites. Because you're not looking at changing how the whole team is working because everyone works so differently. But you, if you have sort of referral criteria for a specific smaller team, you can have increased capacity to use behavioral interventions. So motivational interviewing in particular is something we hear a lot about, but I think it requires a high degree of training, and you have to have the time and the team that's using it in the same way, and that they can coordinate amongst themselves, that they're doing the same thing. I've met people that say that they're doing motivational interviewing, and I wouldn't argue with them. I wouldn't know how to work with them clinically because they're not doing what I'm trying to do. So it's something that takes some training and skill and practice, and I think that it becomes sort of a local knowledge base in a way. That team of six or eight people, they can learn to speak the same language, and it's hard to make those interchangeable elsewhere. So all of this is to lead to what our staffing plan is. So this is what our team looks like. Medical provider, team leader, someone with the prescription privileges. I'm very fortunate to have Dr. Acri, but you know, I think particularly in other settings, CRNPs would be fantastic at this as well. They need a medical assistance. I feel like because it's a behavioral intervention that is what makes this different to work alongside medicine, you need to have a supervising psychologist, that would be me, and then you need folks to have relationships with this entire team. You can't all do it, so the other therapists, and then patient navigators. This could be medical case managers. In the current environment, we're sort of reshuffling that a bit. ACA, I won't digress too much. We feel like to make this team work, even though there's other case management resources, that this team needs their own sort of go-to person to fill those needs. So this is our solution. This is the problem as we see it and what we intend to do about it. We welcome your questions. We have a few more minutes left. John?
This is really great data.
Thank you. Yes, let's go back to the data slide. Yeah. This is the goods right here.
I really applaud the team-based care approach here. And I was wondering, when you're thinking about empowerment, how big is the panel size for that staffing plan? So one provider and, you know, three therapists or whatever.
Right. So how many can that, if they're all full-time and dedicated only to doing that,
yes,
for non-adherent patients, what's the panel size? So we're not entirely sure. We want to say 100, 200, 150.
Yeah. In that neighborhood.
This is a high-powered. These are the most difficult folks to work with. These are, you know, there's the most highest rates of severe mental illness, substance abuse, etc. So
if you think about
like
super
that.
Utilizer data and stuff like that, that's kind of where we're headed. I mean, this is an intervention that we're talking about, that we're getting started, that we haven't really fully.
Yeah, this is the design.
I have 170 patients right now, but they're not all super utilizers. They wouldn't all fall into this. They're not HIV positive.
Yeah, so full disclosure, I was recently hired by the HCA, but I have a question nonetheless.
Yeah.
So looking at this cascade and really trying to improve adherence from, like you said, the most difficult to treat patients, especially when thinking about like treatment as prevention, reducing community viral load, the importance of all that, it made me think of the work that Paul Farmer has done and Partners in Health and the successes they've had. And so I guess I wanted to ask, what are your thoughts on maybe also including maybe directly observed therapy, mm-hmm, or the use of community health workers to also increase adherence for these patients who are really struggling.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, would that fall under the patient navigator role?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah, so community health workers like Lupe, we need to recognize the rest of our staff here as well, who are sitting in the audience, would help us by going into the community and finding people. There's a lot of work that's been done in Africa of putting somebody on a motorbike and going out into the rural communities to bring people in. We have transportation services, we can bring people back. Lupe's brother Nelson has a car at his disposal to go pick up people and bring them into care. And that's really what we pride ourselves on as an agency. In addition to the housing piece of it, really goes about, we have to talk about that too. It's part of this too, and how we've done so well is we provide housing for our patients that don't have houses. And we're interested in doing more of that. And really, housing is medicine. Largely that's what's been able to get our clients doing so well.
And directly observe therapy? And
well, so I think when the community health workers go out, I think they can make sure the patients have their meds. Where do they keep them? Do they keep them in a shoebox in the back of the closet without lids on that they're spilling all over the place and they never pull them out because nobody in the house knows they have HIV? They're not taking their meds. So then we need to find them a different living situation. Or
right.
We need to, all of that, that's all a piece of
And to tie the first presentation to this presentation is that Ryan-wide entities should use 340B, they should be competitive, they should use this as a revenue source, and they should use it clinically. This provides us the pharmacy refill data, the adherence data, that lets us have a better idea of what's going on with our patients. It's often underutilized data if you don't run the pharmacy yourself. And this is part of the tool. I think this is part of what can make this better. And absolutely, the DFT can be part of that if you have a pharmacy or contract pharmacy.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.